Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Now, on Monday, we spoke to Ellie. Ellie had been attacked and a number of items stolen from her at Tara Street railway station, the centre of Dublin. And now we've been contacted by the Hennessy family. And Brendan Hennessy is on the line. Brendan, this happened to your mother this day 2 weeks ago, June the 4th, around 11 o'clock in the morning. What happened, Brendan?
That's correct. That's right, Joe. Good afternoon to you. Yeah, this day 2 weeks ago, Mum was coming into Dublin, into Pier Street Station. Now, this is a journey, Joe, that she's been doing for 60 years in her working life. And at a quarter past 11 or so, she'd come off the Dart, I suppose, and had popped into a shop along Westland Row.
Mm-hmm.
While she was in the shop on her way out, she noticed somebody had dropped something on the floor, you know.
Okay.
Another customer, I suppose, a woman. And so Mum picked up whatever she had dropped and happened to be going the same direction and followed the same direction to, you know, where that woman was going, and ended up, I think, she around Fenian Street, caught up with her.
Yeah,
just and
off.
Just said to her, yeah, it's opposite the Davenport there, Joe.
Yeah.
And she said to her, you know, she just went up to the woman and said, excuse me. That's as much as far as she got.
Okay.
The woman turned around and punched her just above the eye.
My God.
It's absolutely shocking, Joe. And poor Mum, the next thing she knew, she told me that she just fell out onto the road.
A busy road.
You know, a busy road, indeed. And that's part of where Mum is at now, kind of realising what could have been. But what happened next then, Joe, was that, let's put it like this, a friend of the assailant helped Mum to her feet, shouting after her friend who had run away, now look what you've done.
God.
And with that, two kind women from a nearby office, I think, came out to help Mum, and as a family, we'd like to thank those two women, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you can just imagine the shock of an unprovoked attack, you know, when you've been going through the working in Dublin for all those years and something like that to happen. And, you know, Mum is one of the many, many resilient women of her generation.
Mm-hmm.
So, Joe, you wouldn't believe what she did next.
Wow.
She went on to work.
Wow. But hang on, Brendan, if your mother, Nadine, if she has been travelling in the city centre for 6 years, that means she's in her early 80s, at least.
She's approaching 80, let's say, Joe.
Okay, good woman, okay.
Yes.
And she kept going.
And I think this is a little lesson maybe for ourselves as a family and anybody else who's assisting somebody who's had this experience. We were bowled over by Mum's resilience. Absolutely. She's fantastic. And, you know, she had other things to attend to the following day and the day after. And we thought, wow, she's doing brilliant. But to be honest, Joe, then, in her own words, she slumped.
Mm-hmm.
And my mum is an extremely active woman, and she has found herself absolutely exhausted. You'd want to see the bruising. Well, you don't want to see the bruising, Joe, to be honest with you. But I suppose Mum, in hindsight now, is thinking, I could have broken a hip.
Yeah.
I could have, you know, broken, a bone. She's really conscious the woman just caught her above the eye. Had she caught her in the eye, how, you know, what would have happened? And I think for those of us who are trying to support people following an incident like this, you know, people can be remarkably resilient. But on the other hand, they need support, they need time, they need care. And Mum, who, as I say, is very active, has been exhausted for the last 2 weeks. And that's the impact of this, of a situation like this on someone.
And then she fell onto what is probably one of the busiest bus corridors in the city, and then a busy traffic street as well there, just outside of Davenport. I mean, I'm sure that's on
constant replay in her mind.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, the what ifs, the what could have beens, you know, and, you know, thankfully Mum, you know, didn't have that injury, but is there a trauma? Yes. You know, is there a legacy to this?
Yeah.
Yes, you know. I asked Mum how would she feel, or what advice would she give to people now?
Okay.
And she, you know, Mum's confident. She said, you know, she doesn't want to put people off coming into Dublin City. And I think that's an important message. But she's advising them to be cautious. And she'd be saying, you know, maybe she wouldn't undertake that act of kindness now, after this experience. And that's a terrible thing, you know?
And Brendan, do we know what your mother picked up?
It may have been, do you know those casings for cigarettes, Joe?
The roll your own stuff. The roll your own packet. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think she thinks that's what it was.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. First of all,
not being facetious, but I don't know whether he's had that image of Trump and Keir Starmer when Trump's papers blew all over the place at the G7. And it was Starmer who had to bend down to pick up the papers because Trump wasn't inclined for whatever reason. Your mother bent down, picked up the package that the woman had accidentally dropped, walked, obviously upped her pace a bit, walked and said...
Caught
up with her. And said, excuse me, and she turned around with a fist into your mother's face.
Like, it's kind of unthinkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
And well, Mum said that the woman caught her with some force, you know, and she obviously did. She knocked her right out onto the road.
CCTV?
I haven't heard that, Joe, but she has. What is important is she has reported it to the guards.
Oh, well done,
and we'd like to thank the guards for taking her report. But the importance of the report isn't so much that Mum will get necessarily a response to it, but that if there is, as your show is showing, there's enough of these incidents happening, she does feel that the policing needs to be upped, and people need to be vigilant.
When you asked her that, sorry, Brennan, but what you said to her, what do you want me to say? What did she say about going into Dublin, into the city centre, that she's done for six decades?
It is that message of being cautious, Joe. But I actually asked her another question. I said, Mum, what's the difference between Dublin as you remember it and Dublin now? Mm-hmm. You know? And she said, people don't look as happy as they used to.
Okay.
And Joe, I was thinking about this, you know, you and your show have brought a lot of hope and happiness to people over the years, particularly as you finish up. Let's take the time to give each other space, kindness and so forth. That's, I think, what Mum would like. You know, let people acknowledge each other, greet each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and even for the person who assailed her, maybe she needs help, and maybe we give room for that help. And, you know, because none of us, and I say Mum's working, no business in Dublin wants to see less people in Dublin City.
And it is a great city, and there is a great buzz, and there's a great geography to it, and a shape to it, and extraordinary. Few cities in the world have as much history embedded in the city centre, so to speak, in every shape and form. Will your mother go back to work?
There's no stopping her. Oh, Joe.
Brilliant.
Joe, there's no stopping her. But she did say, and she reflected on her own level of fitness. And she was saying, you know, if anybody's out there listening, you know, and they're, you know, in their whatever, their 70s or 80s even, you know, and they have the opportunity, and not everybody does, but if they do have the opportunity to keep up their fitness, their physical health, you know, she reflects, maybe that's why there isn't a broken bone. That's why she was able to get back up. That's why. So I suppose as a family...
Given your wonderful description of your mother, I thought you were going to say, when I said, will your mother go back to work, you might say something, of course she has to go back to work, Joe. There's only a few female steeplejacks still working in Dublin.
I tell you, you won't find harder, you know, more determined. Yeah. And, you know, we're obviously incredibly proud of Mum, and I hope she hears that. Yeah. But I think it's important that her message is one of not of fear, but it is about caution. And it is about taking care of yourself and taking care of yourself for the future.
Okay, and then we'd also say it happened this day 2 weeks ago at 11:15 at the junction of, it's top of Lincoln Place, Westland Row, around into Clare Street.
Exactly.
Very busy spot. If anyone can be of assistance to the Gardaí who are in Pierce Street, that would be appreciated. And I'm also very conscious of what you said, Brendan, and what your mother said, that this woman who did such an unprovoked attack on your mother needs help. She needs help.
I think that's an important message, just that we take everybody into account here. We want safer streets, without a shadow of a doubt. And, you know, if there are people out there who need help, we need to get that to them. But on the other hand, you know, people don't deserve to be walking through Dublin fearing that this might happen to them.
Okay, stay with us, Brendan. Joe at RT.ie. Owen McMahon. Owen, good afternoon. Pierce Street, what happened in Dublin?
Yeah, I was on the side of the road picking up some litter, which Gulls had ripped a few sacks apart.
Oh, yeah, okay, the seagulls, yeah.
Yeah, so I just happened to notice I was driving by my car, stopped the car, lucky enough, for the Brazilian delivery driver, and I was clearing it up, and I was talking to the workers in the takeaway where the bags had emanated from, and they didn't understand much English either.
Okay.
Right? So anyway, I heard a whole lot of shouting behind me on the other side of the road. This is Pierce Street.
Yeah, busy.
7 o'clock, summer's evening, yeah. Lovely sunny evening. So I heard a shouting behind me. And turned out, when I turned around, it was a taxi driver who was stopped in the middle of the road. Mm-hmm. And then there was a Liberty driver who was remonstrating or being attacked by these youths, about five or six youths.
Yeah.
And so I didn't think anything of it. I mean, I just got back to clean the litter. And all of a sudden, this delivery driver ran across to my side of the road and he tripped. Whereupon, five of them started kicking his head. His helmet had come off. Okay. He was like, he was riding an e-bike, very fast e-bike. You know those e-bikes?
Yeah.
So his helmet had come off when he tripped. And they were literally kicking his head as he lay on the ground. Now, I managed to guess them off from as best as I could. This is in the middle of the road now.
Yeah.
Pierce Street, in the bus lane.
Yeah.
So, lucky enough, after a minute, now, lucky enough, the youths were sort of 14, 15. So I'm a big enough guy, so I was able to fend them off, you know. Lucky enough, they didn't have a knife or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But
And were they shouting anything or saying anything?
Well, this is it. They were shouting, but I didn't interfere when I heard the shout. But when they were attacking him on the ground, they weren't shouting at me. Now, at this point, his bike was laying in the middle of the ground on the other side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to me and the delivery driver, they stole that.
Ah, for God's sake.
Yeah. Now, once I drove them around, after this passerby helped me and they scattered the youths, I offered to drive them around the area to see if we could find the bike, you know, the flats around the area. And so couldn't see him after about 10, 15 minutes. I offered to drive him into Pierce Street Garda Station.
Right.
Now, to say he hadn't a word of English is an understatement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, in hindsight, he was living in Finglas. So this is like 7 o'clock, half 7. I needed to do other stuff, you know. So I should have driven to Finglas. He'd no money on him. To get the bus.
Don't be hard on yourself, Owen. You were brilliant.
Look, and so now, unfortunately, I didn't report it. Now, in the meantime, there's been other activity in that area with this. I'm thinking they're the same gang of youths. There's like 100 or over 100 of these youths, and they create havoc.
As you say, it's near. It's on Pierce Street, and there is a Garda station known as Pierce Street Garda Station.
Yeah. Now, can I just give an example?
Yeah, yeah.
Last week...
Sorry, go on, yeah.
Yeah. Last week, my car was attacked a few months after the incident with the delivery driver on two separate nights where these youths are hiding in a little sort of lay-by and they're throwing all types of instruments at cars as they pass by, okay? Yeah. Now, the first time it happened to me, I didn't do anything about it. I just said, forget about it. Second time, I went into the Garda station to report it. And I wasn't really taken seriously because it was only an egg, right? Now, I'm talking, my car was destroyed with these eggs, right? So I was actually going into the Pierce Street Garda station last week to report something else.
Well, as we know, it's one of the busiest stations in the country. Oh, and by the way, you mentioned earlier that you stopped to pick up rubbish. Do you do that often?
I'm spending about 10 hours a week doing it because the council hasn't done it.
Well done. You're doing it yourself. Fair play.
Well, I just know that if I don't do it, it'll stay there for months.
Okay.
because the council are only focused on the city centre core retail area. They don't clean past Holland Street and Fitzwilliam Square.
Well, that's great. Great. Well, they do, but I take your point overall.
Can I give you just one other thing before that's
about briefly, yeah.
Yeah. There was a TikTok last week whereby in the same area, some guy was obviously in an apartment overhead, and he filmed this particular action of five youths attacking a delivery driver from the same flats. Now, the five of them chasing them out in the middle of the road.
Well, we don't know where they're from, but we know where it happened. I think I saw that TikTok thing. I presume as well, Owen, the Gardaí will have a look at videos like that as well. Okay, Owen, thanks indeed. Brendan, hopefully your mother makes a full... But Brendan, can I ask you, what does she work at, Nadine? Your mother?
She works in office administration in
great.
The city.
Well,
and she does an amazing job.
And the city is all the better for her.
Absolutely.
Okay. Kind regards and thank you so much, Brendan.
And Joe, likewise, for many people in the community, thank you to you. Congratulations on your career.
Oh, thanks very much. You're very kind, Brendan. Good to meet him, Mahogood. It's a privilege. Joe with RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Hey, Mick Higgins, Michael, good afternoon.
How are you doing?
Good,
how are things?
Good, Mick. We just heard from Owen there. It took some civic cleansing, he said, into his own hands, so to speak. You've taken some civic duty in your own, into your own hand and your own paintbrush and your own paint. What have you done, Mick?
Well, like this now, I'm looking for this work to be done in Westport for years.
Okay.
And there is a lot of disabled parking spaces that you cannot see.
Okay.
The disabled signs on the road. And there's a few places that have no signs that this is a disabled parking space, you know. So I've gone to the local council and I had a chat with them because I have a few other issues that's going on for years.
Okay. And when you say you can't see, there are disabled spots, but the paint is worn
faded.
Off. They're faded.
Yeah,
okay.
So, and I have a lot of issues with e-scooters and bikes on the roads or on the footpath, people cycling on it. Now, my daughter is a woman. She's not a baby, but she has the mentality of a 10-year-old because... Okay. She's handicapped and blind.
Wow.
But I've gone to the council on years ago and there's still nothing done. Like, I'm not going to get out of the way with someone cycling a bike on the footpath or an e-scooter. But I'm waiting for some of them to hit me or my daughter. But anyway, getting back to
the faded paint.
Parking signs. I went up there 2 months ago to the council and I was told they haven't got the money to paint the signs on the road. So about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, one of our councillors came out and says that they have, I don't know what sort of a fund, that there's 15 million in it. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. We have three or four councillors in the town here.
Okay.
And, you know,
but anyway, you're okay. The council, I have a statement from the council, and they say they don't mention money. They say we're currently assessing the condition of all designated disabled parking areas in the area. Stop laughing, Mick. Stop laughing.
Yes.
Road lining works.
I am laughing because I'm waiting for months for this, years.
So what did you? You went out and bought paint yourself.
I went out and bought a gallon of paint and brushes.
Yeah.
And painted, and I painted three on Monday night in 2 hours, 3 hours.
You painted up the disabled spots. You did blue over the
three,
blue.
Three of them.
Blue
over the blue and white over the white.
White, okay.
And it wasn't a rocket science, like, you know.
And is it proper paint for roads? I don't know if there is.
I have rubber paint. Got it specially mixed up for myself.
Rubber,
you know.
You can guess such a thing as rubber paint.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you tell the shopkeeper I want to paint signs on the road?
Yes.
Okay, brilliant.
Yes.
Okay.
White and blue.
And what about the shade of blue?
The shade of blue is
a lighter shade.
90% as well. Sure, I don't know because you cannot see the blue in half the, disabled person.
But
the
you think you might have got a...
Well, I've been complimented a lot since Monday.
For painting...
Since yesterday.
For painting the town blue. Well done. Now, the shade, and you reckon the shade you used was is as close to the blue.
Yes.
Is there name? Is there name in that shade?
I'm after giving it the paint to another man there now. He's going to he's going to paint a disabled spot down in Belmullet.
Okay, where there is a disabled spot, he's going to...
There is disabled spots, but great. You cannot see them, John.
That kind of does take away the... As I say, the council say we remain committed to ensuring accessibility and safety for our residents.
Sure, I've listened to that for months.
We appreciate the community's engagement. That's you, Mick. We appreciate the community's engagement and we'll continue to prioritise inclusive access as part of our ongoing public realm improvement efforts.
Yeah. But, sir, I went to the council office there Monday looking for someone to talk to. Yeah. And I went to the council yard for someone to talk to because I have other issues and it's all about old age pensioners and... Okay. People in wheelchairs and people that get it, find it very hard to walk on footpaths and, you know, but it's not nice now. So
I was in Westport about four Saturdays ago.
Yeah.
I was only there for one night. My God, it's busy.
Oh, it's a great
town. The pubs
town.
Are busy, the restaurants
town,
are busy. There was a lovely atmosphere as well.
Yeah, it's a great town. I'm proud to be a Westport man.
So if there's drink being sold and food being sold and various other things being sold, you can be sure the Exchequer is getting a fair few bob out of that busyness in Westport.
I'm not begrudging anyone making money. Really?
Yeah. I'm saying there's a lot of taxes being spent and collected in Westport.
Well, I pay my tax.
Yeah, of course.
I pay my local property tax and I'm not getting much.
But I'm saying even on a point in Matt Malloy's, Matt has to pay €1.52 to the state for selling you the pint.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Mick, you mentioned that Emma is visually impaired, and I think you used the word blind, and is intellectually disabled.
Yes.
I came across a new device this morning. I don't know what it's called. Meta Smart Glasses. Have you heard about these? It's for it's a visually impaired pal of mine, Oren, who showed them to me. They're very new, but they're incredible. If you are visually impaired, you put on these glasses. For all intents and purposes, they look like sunglasses. Okay?
Yeah.
And then when you put on the glasses and you're visually impaired, say you drop something. You drop a packet of sweets on the floor or a packet of tablets and you want to try and find them. You can say, Meta, ring. There's a number you can, there's a name on this app. Ring this app. The app says, the person at the other end says, hello. They're now looking at your camera from your glasses, your smart glasses.
Yeah. But you're talking, Joe, about visually impaired. My daughter is blind.
Yeah, but
completely
she's
completely blind.
No, my point is that just to explain it to you, because I just want to know, is there anyone else in Ireland using them? I hope people are aware of them. That is the thing. You have no eyesight. So you say to the glass, you put on the glasses. They don't make any difference to your vision. But what they do is there's a camera built into the glass, into the glasses. There's a microphone built into the glasses. And obviously there's a lot of technology. So you can say, you can say, Meta, what am I looking at now? And the Meta will say to you, you're looking at a door. Is there a number on the door? And Meta will tell you, it's number 44. And the other thing they can do, I want to make people aware of this genius of technology. I know we get a lot of negative about technology. I said, the other thing you can do, we can ring somebody. It's the name of an app. I won't give it out at this stage. You ring them and a person comes down and says, what are you looking for? And say, I've dropped a packet of Rolo. And they you scan your head around and they say walk 3 steps forward, 2 steps to the right, and then right below your left foot. So it is an incredible addition.
All right for people with visually impaired. But my daughter is
would be
sort of handicapped. Well, and I wouldn't be able to. She wouldn't be able to put a pair of glasses on her head.
I understand. And that's why
it's okay for people like she doesn't have a guide dog.
Yeah.
Now, my wife raises an awful lot of money for the guide dogs.
Well done,
You know, and she cannot have a cane. Okay. I have to be. I do the same run every Sunday and every Wednesday night. I take the same route. Okay. I have to do the same thing. It's like she has the brain of maybe a 10-year-old, 12-year-old. Okay. She's 35 years of age,
yeah.
But she's that way inclined. That's the way she reacts. Like, you know, she's not just blind and can walk right and talk right. Like, you have to have your ear to the ground when she's talking to
and
you.
And that's one.
Because she could bring up something that she says last week.
Okay.
And if you promise my daughter Emma something. And say, I'll have them next Sunday for you. She'll let you know that she has a brain. Yeah.
Okay.
Where it comes from, I don't know. It didn't come from me anyway.
I'm sure it does. But Mick, and that is why you are so vigilant, and rightly so, not just about the fading, the disappearing disabled spots, so to speak, but the amount of traffic, e-scooters, bikes that now whiz up and down our footpaths.
Yeah, but that's us, you know. You know, and I'm not going to get out of their way. They touch me or my girl, they won't have a bike or a scooter.
Okay.
I'll break it in front of them.
Okay.
And I mean it.
Yeah.
And I've gone to the local Gardaí and they say, you're right, Mick. But there's no one doing anything about it. This is what I cannot understand. Like.
And Mick, I presume, like in most cases, I presume disabled spots. Now, I know people are very good at policing them themselves and checking people, but are disabled spots abused? They are, aren't they? We know that.
They are, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd be conscious of that now, so I would. I'd pull in a couple of yards away from one on the, that's one individual at the bank, like, and you see them jumping out of their car, running to the hole in the wall, and I'd say, excuse me, that's a disabled park. Oh yeah, but I'm only going to the hole in the wall, I want to get some money. But then again, someone might be wanting to get in there.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, it's
do you meet any resistance? Do people tell you to?
Oh, I do, yeah. Oh, I do. Okay. I can get abused and the whole lot.
Okay.
But I'm as thick as them when I start.
Okay.
You know, I can be a very nice man.
You can
man.
Speak.
Speak
up for yourself. Yeah. Speak up for yourself.
Because
you played. You played for Mayo in the '70s. I'm after seeing a text there. Is that the same?
Yeah, but sure. That's water under the bridge, Joe.
Okay,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I've been there, done that.
But you're still
jersey and
great. But you're a great player. But you're still painting the town blue, anyway.
I'm still painting the town blue, but I don't know whether to continue or not because I might cause a street hazard or something. But I've got five or six calls from people that will help me to paint them if I want.
Okay, and take every
precaution,
high vis. But hopefully the council will I'm sure they will
sure
get there. I know what you're going to tell me. You've been you're blue in the face as you trying
blue
to get them
face,
to get the boy blue
it's
paint.
It's a lovely blue that I put on the road.
The blues. Okay.
Yeah.
Keep painting the blues, Mick. Keep painting Westport blue, and above all, a bit of white.
White.
I know, beautiful bit of white. And above all, kind regards to your gorgeous, wonderful daughter Emma.
Yeah, she's
and,
beautiful. So
yeah. Okay. Go to meet a Mahal. Go to meet a Mahal.
And you too.
Slán.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Roddy Collins. Good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
Good.
You keeping well?
Good. What would I introduce you as? Football manager. Well, I list all the teams you managed over the years.
No, Joe, you need to do another year on your contract to
list all my. But I mentioned the football player. Well, I mentioned all the teams you played for over the years.
No, Joe, you couldn't. You'd be there in a month. Joe, just say, Roddy, the chancellor. I tried everything, Joe.
Okay.
And you know the worst thing about it is, I say that most of it.
keep failing, keep failing. Now tell us about this prank you played on the day that's in it. When someone has a ticket somewhere, as you know, Roddy, in this country, we don't know if it's a syndicate, we don't know if it's one person, and we don't know if many people are involved. The ticket has EuroMillions ticket with the numbers 13, 22, 23, 44, 49, and the two lucky stars, 3 and 5. Now, the ticket must have been bought before the draw last night, because as I said earlier, I know a few people who bought a winning numbered ticket after the event and then pretended, and the person I was thinking of was you, because I read about it in your wonderful autobiography, volume 1, called The Rod Father. Tell us what you did, you brat.
Ah, but Joe, it was only 3 and a bit million. Like, it wasn't 200 million. We'd not be taking the biscuit, that would. No, I didn't think. I thought it was very funny, actually, at the time. It was, we were skint, we hadn't got a shilling. And I was dreaming a couple of numbers, and they come up with the lottery. So the next day, I went around the shop, and I bought a ticket for the following Wednesday with all the winning numbers. So I left it there. Carolyn was tidying up, but she found it. And
you had got the winning numbers of the most recent draw. Okay. And you bought those numbers.
Yeah, and I put them down. And Carolyn picked her up, and she went, Rod, sit down. I says, why? She says, oh, Jesus, oh, Rod, please. Read them numbers. We read them. Oh, look what we're at the win. And I went, it's only money, relax. And I thought she'd cop on straight away. Yeah. Have a laugh there. Then I had to go out of the house training. And the longer I went on, Joe, the more I physically realised I'm in a serious situation, you know.
So Caroline thought she was a millionaire.
I'm convinced. I'm not thought. Oh, no, she was. Because I went to a chap to pick him up. I got to ring the house, ring me, and where was I? And she says, oh, I told me not to tell anyone, but we're at the winning 3 and a million. You know? And I went, oh, no. So next of all, I'm driving down by North Eckler Road, and all Caroline's family, 5 sisters, 3 brothers, all heading up, all party mode, you know? And I'm going, oh, Jesus, I'm in it now, big time. So they all arrived at the house, big hoolie, bottles of Chemist, and you name it. And they're all singing and dancing the whole lot, blah, 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 blah. So about 2 hours into this big hoolie, Stephen Collins copped on, and he told Caroline, and she was in denial. Oh, she said she's going to steal the shop, you know.
Okay, now just to be clear, I want to be clear on one thing, right? That you got the numbers. You, when you sat down, and Caroline said, because I want to get into this conversation just for a second. Caroline said, yeah. Roddy, we won 3.1 million. She firmly believed it. She believed she was a millionaire. Did you have a conversation there? Will we tell anybody? Or what will we do? Or did you have any?
I had a panic attack, Joe. That's the truth. I said, Caroline, it's only money. Relax. Don't let the kids out of the house run around telling anyone in case they get knocked down. Just keep it calm till they go home. And I thought, copper out. But no, it got worse. And then when Stephen identified it, Caroline was so convinced.
Yeah, but the other thing, in the meantime, when your buddy rang the house, the first thing Caroline says to him, after you all agreeing not to tell anyone, the first thing she says to him, we've won the lotto.
Yeah, and as you know, she said, Joe, she said, it's 3 point something, but the point something doesn't matter. But anyway, the hoolie went on. So anyway, the hoolie went on and the hoolie ended. And when I come up, it was World War III. But I said to Caroline, it was 3 million. He gave away 4.5 or 5, which he did. I said, you know, it was only money. And Joe, and it happened on a Sunday morning. And as I said to a researcher, it took me Wednesday to get back into the big bed. I couldn't get a word in for 3 days. I was vilified by the whole family.
Because
if you can imagine, Caroline had me over a barrel. And then all her sisters and all, they're looking at me. I was getting a house out of it. I was getting a car out of it. So it was all my fault. Do you know what I mean? But look, Joe, at the time it happened, I thought it was a funny joke. But an hour or two into it, I realised it was anything but funny. And then I grovelled me way out of it.
And it was Stephen Collins, your neighbour in Cabra, the boxer.
No, my brother.
Yeah, Stephen. Yeah, your brother my even. Brother. Stephen yeah. came in, and Stephen picked up the ticket, and he spotted the date.
He looked at the ticket, because Carolyn said, where's the ticket? He says, I have a head. He said, show me the ticket.
I always thought Stephen was the brightest in your family, Roddy. Fair play to him.
That's why he's a world champion.
Exactly.
That's why he's a world champion. Exactly. But he couldn't have been that bright, Joe. He's got punched in the head for 40 years. But he went to call it. So he discovered it, and that was it. But do you know what the moral of the story is, Joe? And whoever has the winning ticket, right, enjoy the party, because afterwards it's all downhill. Okay. Everyone fell out me after that, you know?
And did you make up what you said? It was nearly 4 or 5 days before you were let back into the master bedroom, so to speak.
That's it.
As it's called in real life. And did the relatives who had, in their imagination, bought cars, houses, trips to Lanzarote, did they forgive you?
Now, it took a bit longer, Joe. I'll be quite honest. It took a bit longer.
But everyone knows you're everyone knows you're a bit of crack.
Ah, Joe, I thought I was a bit of crack. But let's be honest. I mean, I haven't got time to tell you how I was dropped in it years ago. I know how it feels to be as absolute high and happiest person on the planet. Now, 5 minutes later, on the floor, I've been there. But I didn't think I could do that to my wife and kids. But look, I said I was sorry, and Joe, I'm apologising ever since.
Thank God.
So there you go. And Joe, see if I did win that 260 million last night.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't tell her.
You keep the secret for 10 seconds, Roddy. 10 seconds.
I'd ring her from the Bahamas.
and reverse the charges. What would you advise someone with 250 million? What do you say to them?
Well, make sure it's a winning ticket. And it's
check the date.
Well, Joe, do you know what I'm not a money person, by the way. I would advise them to sit down and settle down and keep it quiet, because the afters where I was getting a house, I was only getting a car, I was getting a cruise, that in itself, in my opinion, would create a conflict within a family dynamic.
Okay.
You know, so if you have 260 odd million, well, it depends on who wins, of course, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Joe, it's too much money for one person.
Ah, yeah, but don't refuse
it's
it.
It's too much money for but one person.
And I remember in your book, The Rottfather, I know Paul Howard gave you a hand, but it's a fantastic book, The Rottfather. But I know the book, at the beginning of the book, when you're talking about going out with Caroline, you hadn't a juice. You hadn't a Red Rex between you.
Never had a penny, Joe. And you know what? I earned lots of money. I did. And I'm okay. I'm grand now.
Okay.
I earned lots of money, but I was poor. And a pal of mine who bought a house for $4.5 million 15 years ago started contracting with me. I won't name him. Started contracting with me when I was plaster contracting, and he was doing another trade. And I said, how are you about to buy that? He said, Rod, we were earning about $3,000 a week 30 years ago. You were spending $6,000. And I was.
Okay.
I was in Louis Copeland's 5 days a week, Joe. I kept the shop going on my own.
And Roddy, what is your, just given the day that's in it and the weather that's in it and the time of the year and unfortunately the world that's in it at the minute, what's your motto in life? Have you got a motto?
My motto in life is, if you can do something good once a day to anybody, do it. I'm out here in Spain. I bring out 4 cigarettes in a little cart, and there's a man out here who has nothing. And all he goes is, amigo, cigarette.
Every day.
And I give him that, and I feed them every day. And I feed the pigeons and the fish down in the marina down in Cambrils. And I get more happiness out of that. Honestly, I do, Joe. And like, I listened to your show earlier about that poor woman and the whole lot. Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
I know.
Do something. Look, Joe, I'm not a saint. But look, if you can do, as my man always said, if you can do someone a good turn, do it. If you've nothing good to say about someone, say nothing. I'm live by that, you know.
How's Caroline?
Ah, she's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant. She's up to walking herself into doing a barbecue with the neighbours next door. I have never, ever, ever in my life lit a barbecue.
Oh, here we go.
Right?
And
we're Googling. Yeah.
Okay, get the number of the Bomberos, the fire brigade.
I'm a big booker.
I knew two firemen in Spain, Roddy. You know that. Jose and Jose B.
Well, I might be the two of them.
Yeah, might be the two of them. Okay, Roddy. Great to hear that story. You're a tonic. Thanks a million, Roddy. Yeah, you're a tonic.
As I say, a game of football has 4 quarters, I call it. You're in the last quarter, Joe. Yeah. Leave everything out in that pitch. Enjoy it.
Okay.
Best of luck to you, Joe.
You too, old pal. That's a wonderful Roddy Collins. Right. Do track down his book, The Rottfather, even in your library. Now, from I mentioned there, Roddy, one of the things that really struck me in the book, he hadn't the juice. And I think he was trying to get a raise, and he was an apprentice carpenter or apprentice plasterer, so he wasn't being paid much. But anyway, unfortunately, Richard Seabury has contacted us. Richard Seabury is in Roscommon, and unfortunately, you're in a situation now, Richard, where you have to close your business. Tell us about the business and why you have to close it.
Yeah, hi Joe, thanks for having me on. The business is, or was, well, I suppose it still is, Black Donkey Brewing In Ballinlough and Roscommon, we're the only brewery in the county. We've been brewing now for about 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the short snapshot version of it, I suppose, is that the business was founded on passion and folded on pragmatism. Market forces just simply were not, the brewery was not in position to provide for me and staff what we wanted and needed. And so whilst we were in a position to close rather than being forced to close, we decided that it was made more sense to draw a line under it than keep trudging forwards.
And what's that like? If your passion brewing and is such a skill as well. Your passion, say you're the only one in Roscommon. What's that like, even psychologically, having to shut it down?
To be honest with you, Joe, it's the outpouring of sympathy and support over the last 48 hours or so since the news went public has been fantastic. But it's really not the end of the world.
We've mentioned it before, but have you been hit by rising electricity costs and supplies and materials?
Yeah. I mean, our cost of doing business has just increased exponentially since round about 2020 was the first big increases.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems like COVID is a long way in the rearview mirror for a lot of people, but certainly for those of us at the thin end of the wedge, the after effects of COVID are still very, very tangible. And costs that increased in 2020, we have seen some minor rollbacks of some of those costs, but certainly nothing of the order of what we need in order to make a business of this scale.
And I presume you depend
sustainable.
You depend on brewing a lot on electricity.
100%, yeah. Electricity went from just being sort of a line item on the budget to being our largest single overhead.
Wow.
More even than our rent.
Wow.
So, yeah, it went up significantly. And, you know, we were, at one point in time, we were buying 100% green electricity generated from wind turbines here in Ireland. And when the Russian gas crisis started, cost of power went up. As far as I'm aware, the cost of wind on a mountaintop in Mayo didn't increase, but yet global market is such that if one source goes up, every source goes up. And I thought that was a bit incongruous, but, you know, we're not in a position to fight those powers and that level of force.
And what would your electricity bill be every year?
We could be up around 15 to 20,000 euro a year, depending on our production, depending on weather.
But what is the stat? Are we the highest or the second highest in all of Europe, anyway?
Yeah.
So, Richard, what will you do with all the brewing equipment?
Well, that's for sale at the moment.
Okay.
As you can probably imagine, there's not a huge market for used brewing equipment in Ireland. A lot of what we have, fairly generic sort of stainless steel tank, so I'm hoping we'll find outlets for them.
Okay, and it's info at blackdonkeybeer.com. Where did the Black Donkey moniker come from?
From the story Mossel Bjug Dov.
Ah.
We were originally going to call the brewery Connacht Brewing, and we were going to brew a stout and call it Ossel Dov. We decided against Connacht, hard to trademark a place name, so we were going to call the brewery Ossel Dov, and then we said if we go to export, that won't play very well. So we just translated it to Black Donkey, and we sort of embraced the Eeyore effect. You know, everybody likes a donkey. Everybody wants to give a donkey a hug.
A little Black Donkey.
It worked very well for us.
Okay. And yeah. Hold on to the name anyway, at least.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we had a buyer lined up for the brewery, unfortunately, as a going concern. Unfortunately, that deal didn't come to fruition last year. And, you know, licensing laws have made it very, very difficult for the independent brewing sector. Over 11 years, I honestly thought that the government would see sense and maybe redraw some of the licensing laws, make it easier for people like us to sell direct to consumers and also increase the number of outlets. You know, the filling station next door to the brewery here, you can buy a bottle of Argentinian wine in there, but you can't buy a bottle of Irish beer because of the prohibitive cost of licensing. It just, on no plane of reality can anybody ever justify that. It just doesn't make sense. But yet, that's what we face.
And my memory of Mossel Bjug Dov in primary school with Páraig O'Connor, isn't it a short story about, I'm thinking of Roddy Collins here, is a short story about a man who buys a little black donkey and he thinks he's struck gold. He thinks he's going to get a lot more out of it than he did. But anyway.
No, he thinks he's going to get it for a bargain price, and then he kind of gets gold a little bit on the deal. So, but it has a happy ending, and the two of them bond and go out and work in the bog, and everything happy ever after.
And someone said you also have a brand called Sheep Stealer.
Yeah, so Sheep Stealer is our flagship beer brand. years ago when I was living in New York, somebody asked me where my wife was from. I said, Roscommon, and they said, she's a sheep stealer. So, and I didn't know the story being in Drogheda. I'd never heard it.
Okay.
You know,
they're not.
The football team.
No, they're not sheep stealers, as we know.
Historically, they might have been.
Exactly.
Okay,
Richard Almos, I still hear a lot of energy in your voice, Richard, and your tone and your timbre. Yeah. So touch wood. It's info@blackdonkeybeer.com. Anyone who wants more information. Okay, Richard, good to meet him. I'll get Joe with RT.ie. Let me go before the break to Ciara. Ciara Lynch, good afternoon.
Joe, how are you? How are things?
Grand. Well, how are things for you? I know you've been on before with a Sage and Stone restaurant, and it was about what Richard's talking about there, the cost of business.
Talk to you about. Look, I hate being the one who's moaning all the time because, you know, like I work hard to bring a lovely business outside Duleek. You know, we have a restaurant, gift shop, takeaway. We've 37 people employed, and it's the cost of doing business. Like we'll have no restaurants in Ireland in the next 10 years if the cost of doing business is the way it is. Like I have no problem the increase in the labour costs. Everyone had to have a living wage, but it doesn't match with the service industry, and it doesn't work. And with the increase in all the energy bills and just everything. Food, like coffee has gone up, has doubled, chocolate has doubled, butter pretty much doubled in the last few years. So it's hard to kind of absorb all those costs. I'm a very optimistic person.
So how do you keep going, Ciara?
Well, to be honest, I work really hard to keep my place busy. And as an outsider, people would think I'm probably loaded and making, but every single penny, and I'm very hopeful that the government are going to bring the VAT back this year. But if it doesn't happen, people are just hanging on until that.
Well, they're still.
And if it doesn't happen, there's just no point.
They're sticking with that. They're saying they will bring the hospitality
VAT
down.
They will, but you know you can't.
Now there's a lot of there's opposition to it. I know. I heard Owen Reedy of ICTU on yesterday saying they don't agree with reducing the hospitality taxes. You probably know, but you're saying
jobs
will be lost.
Yeah, but I can tell you, Joe, if I was in the nighttime business, I would. It's really hard because now I'm a daytime business. I'm open 7 days a week. I have a free car park, and people travel miles for a free car park. And if I was in the daytime business or in the nighttime business in a town, apart from Dublin, maybe, you may forget about it.
Yeah,
so what's the future of our towns and villages in Ireland if the cost of doing business is the way it is? We'll just have vending machines for your burger or pizza on the side of the road from now on.
Yeah, good point. Okay, Ciara, Stage and Stone, what I've seen, I actually looked it up the last time on Google there. It's a fantastic campus you have. Remind listeners, because we want people to visit you, where are you based?
We're just outside Duleek, between Duleek and Julianstown.
Okay.
We have free car park, we have a doggy park for people to run their dogs around, we have a restaurant to take away. But we have a busy spot. And thank you for taking my call. And, your show is an unbelievable show. What are we going to do when you go, Joe?
There'll be loads of the team says the same, and it'll go on and on.
And I wish I was at your stage now. I just have to educate a few more kids first.
Okay.
And then I'll do probably a similar thing. But
you don't have a bit of paper there with the numbers 13, 22, 23, 44, 49. And Lucky Stars 3 and 5 written on it and dated before yesterday.
Two of that 250 would have done me.
Keep going, Ciara. That's Ciara Lynch Burke and the wonderful Sage and Stone just outside Duleek. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I don't think I fully understood. I've been covering it for many years, organ donation. But I fully understood the import of the new legislation, the change, the opt-out legislation. And I know it's quite nuanced and it's not as far as some people wanted to go. But the enormous outpouring of joy and hope from so many people waiting on a transplant. And I kept using the words, and I keep using the phrase of Frank Deasy, who died waiting on a transplant. and it was on Liveline so many years ago. If the world is in each one of us, you have the power to change that world. Now, Eileen is on the line. Eileen, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
It was 34 years ago.
Since we last spoke.
4 years and I care to remember.
Yes.
What were we talking about?
Well, my husband, who was 38 at the time, and he actually was doing fine, and then he started feeling very tired, and then within a few weeks he got a few tests and he was diagnosed with a disease called dilated cardiomyopathy. And basically it's the heart muscle weakening. And, you know, imagine the heart being a big, thick elastic band. Mm-hmm. And it was like a shriveled elastic band. So he was not pumping the blood around his body. So he deteriorated very rapidly. I mean, he could have been sick for years, but we didn't know. He seemed fine. And that was March in 91. And then in July, he got very ill and almost died early August, and they put him on the transplant list. And he received a heart. Sorry, I'm a bit emotional.
Take your time, Eileen. I completely understand. First of all, when you say you spoke to me 34 years ago, it's because it was during the summer and I was filling in for the late, great Marion Finucane at the time. So you were close to the edge in terms of hope, and Liam was in severe difficulties, and you appealed for
I did. You were doing some sort of a program on it, and I rang in, and I just said, look, he'll die if he doesn't get a heart. It's as simple as that. We had three small children. The youngest was two. And luckily, he did get a heart on time on Friday the 13th of September.
Brilliant.
So, but I'd just like to impress Joe that how important it is. He lived for another 16 and a half years. So the two-year-old then was 18.
Okay.
And obviously, that was fantastic. And I'd just like to say that although medicine has come a long, long way in those years, none of it is any good if there's no heart to donate. And I would urge people to opt in if they can. I know it's difficult for some people.
We're all opted in now, effectively, thanks to the new law. If you want to opt out, you can. It's fairly simple, as far as I could see, looking at the website yesterday. But even if you do, even if you don't officially opt out, your family would still be asked. But the main thing is the narrative, the story has changed, and that the medics can now raise the issue and say, we don't see your beloved, who's unfortunately in a very difficult position. They're not on the opt-out register. Did they ever talk about organ donation if, God forbid, anything happened? And that's how the belief is, and the hope is, that the number of people donating organs would increase. And that means, you know what that means, not one life, not two lives, not three lives, not four lives. I think there's five different organs that can be transplanted. Eileen, and
it's fantastic, Joe, what they do. I mean, the Mater Hospital, public and private, were very involved with both. They're just fantastic what they do. They're brilliant, and that goes back, because unfortunately, Joe, two of my sons have been diagnosed
with cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, so it's a possibility that they may need transplants down the road. So
okay. Oh, well done, Eileen. It's a long time ago, but
you still
look great. Obviously, I don't remember the specific call. I remember doing.
I taped it, Joe. I have it on a tape somewhere.
Covered. Well, if it was as vivid and as powerful and as moving as this contribution, I can understand how your people were moved, more people moved to put themselves down.
As the lady said yesterday, I think her name was Eileen as well, and she said, have that conversation, I mean, obviously people would be terribly upset in a given situation.
Of course, yeah.
Because the person has to be brain dead, as distinct from, you know, the heart has to be still beating before it is eligible for donation. And if they can remember at all any kind of a conversation, it might just help them.
Of course,
to be at peace with it. But it is very valuable, Joe.
And to be, that's a lovely phrase, to be at peace with the decision for your loved one.
Yes.
Because still, even though the law has changed, a relative would still be asked. And if you could have that conversation, you know you will be, in the awful event of it ever happened, you will be at peace with the decision.
With the decision, and perhaps get joy from it in later years.
Okay. So we spoke 34 years ago.
34 years, Joe. And I'm glad I caught you before you left.
Yeah. I'll speak to you in 2059.
Okay, Joe.
Don't be a stranger. Love to all your family, Eileen. What a wonderful family.
Thank you, Joe.
And God rest, dear Liam. God rest, dear Liam.
Yes. Joe, thank you.
Thank you, Eileen. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Mary O'Shea is on the line. Mary, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And in one sense, you're in the situation that Eileen's family were in, but you are the person. How long have you been as such waiting on a transplant? You there, Mary?
Yeah.
Right, okay. How long have you been? You're on the list now, what, 14 months?
13 months.
Oh, okay. And how did they tell us how that came about?
I have polycystic kidney disease. It's a hereditary condition. And my kidneys worsened after the birth of my last baby. She was born in 2021. And unfortunately, my kidney function decreased dramatically while I was pregnant and just continued to go into downfall after that. I began dialysis in September last year, although I was on the transplant list prior to that.
Okay. And how often are you on dialysis, Mary?
Twice a week. Go to the Braun Centre in Fort Leash. It's a private centre, but it's oversaw by the HSC.
Yeah.
It's a great facility.
What's that, three?
Twice a week.
3-4 hours?
3 hours at the moment. That will increase in time. I'm lucky. I've responded well to dialysis. Getting on okay with it, but it's, you know, your week is based around your dialysis. It's based around your treatment. That can't be interfered with.
And your life, and even at this time of year, I'm thinking, it was alluded to yesterday, if you want to go on holidays, you've got to, be it on the island or off the island, you've got to organise alternative dialysis before you can even think about going away.
Well, to go away outside of Ireland means removing yourself from the transplant list temporarily.
Oh, is it? Okay.
You know, and that's not really something I'm willing to do because it's so rare. I don't think people understand maybe the complexities of trying to get a match. My husband put himself forward to be tested as a potential living donor. Okay. And unfortunately, he wasn't a match. Even in the case of deceased donors, you know, there are organs that there's no match for or no perfect match for.
And that's why we need to get a bigger cohort to be able to harvest from.
The conversations have been happening in homes all the time. Every year there's a drive. The Irish Kidney Association do fantastic work, but it's not translating into numbers of transplants.
Yeah. Well, the opt-out rule now, our law, will hopefully change that.
Because I think it maybe puts a bit more of the onus on the medical teams to approach to their subject.
Yeah.
It gives them a way in, maybe in situations that are highly emotional, and you're very aware as a potential recipient that you're going to be taking an organ from somebody who's much loved, and it's the best news I'll ever get, but it's also going to be the worst news that somebody else will get. And I think the opt-out rather than an opt-in is a good option.
Yeah.
It's a good option, certainly for me. I think for families as well, they might have no doubt now because they'll say, well, if my loved one didn't want to donate their organs, they'd have opted out.
Yeah. And maybe they heard or read or saw stories like your own and the difference this gift would make in the life of somebody else.
Yeah, and I'm not unique. There's upwards of 600 people waiting for organs in Ireland at the moment. You know, and there's 600 lives that are on hold, but it's their families as well.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
stay with us, Mary, because I want to talk to Elizabeth Bennett, just phoned in. Elizabeth, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You were in the awful situation where your son was obviously in close to death and did die, unfortunately, 23 and a half years ago. Can you remember? Of course you remember your boy and never forget him every minute of every day. No. But can you remember the process around the decision, Elizabeth?
Well, our decision was a little different maybe than a lot of people told.
Okay.
We were never asked. We offered.
Brilliant. God bless you.
He fell into a river and coming from a disco, and we were never known. Nobody harmed him. We know.
Okay.
He hit his skull.
Yeah.
Turned out in his post-mortem, his skull was like an eggshell. The other side, he was stunned. This side, he went. So the Garda came to the house, we phoned, and we went to Navan. And on the way up, I said to my husband, if Paul does not come through this, we're giving his organs.
Wow.
And I'm bringing him home. So we were never asked. But it's 23 and a half years ago, hand on heart, it is the best decision we made.
What? And such humanity at such a difficult, horrific time. Horrific and a wound that never heals, I know, for my own brother. But and do you know what prompted you, Elizabeth? Probably your decent humanity.
I'm one of a very big family, and as my husband is, my children have 12 aunts and 7 uncles and 52 first cousins. Anybody, I would always like to think. And years before that, they had little organ donor cards from school, And then there was this saying, don't bring your organs to heaven. Heaven knows we need them here.
Okay. What a beautiful slogan, yeah.
And that lady that was on about her person's worst day, that person is going to go anyway.
Yeah.
So why bring what you don't need?
And when you arrived at the hospital, Elizabeth, I don't want to bring you through every awful moment, but you said it fairly quickly, did you? If his organs can be donated, please do.
Well, at the time, you see, Joe, there was no CT scanner in.
Yeah.
One record, best ICU in this country. They were so good and have been since.
Okay.
As we were leaving the A&E in Navan, I said to the nurse, I said, you know, if this is the worst news, I said, we're going to donate his organs. And she just said, don't think of that yet, he's going to vomit. But I knew I was a mother.
Okay.
I knew before I saw him. But Joe, he gave those people a gift that he did not need. He does not live on in those people. He lives on in his beautiful, beautiful daughter, who is 25. She'll tell me she's in Sydney. She won't know I'm saying that. She's Danielle. Now he has nieces and a nephew. And he lives on in them, and they know all about him. And, he's just their uncle, the same as everybody else.
Okay. And he was called Paul because he was born in John Paul, 1979.
But the John was after my daddy because he died when we were small.
Okay.
And then we just called him
Elizabeth,
Paul.
You say, and it's beautiful what you said about living on in Danielle, and then he also lives on in you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In your...
He's part of every day.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But it's a gift he didn't need. I think the opt-in is brilliant. We know somebody who... You've said several times, he maybe killed me for saying his name, David Crosby from Kingscourt. He ran marathons after getting his lungs. He donor family wants. Make the most of the gift you got, and when it's given willingly, with the help of God, it will help people.
Mm, okay, magnificent.
And it's on average between 5 and 7 transplants from one donor.
Incredible with the kidneys and the different organs. Elizabeth, thank you, and God rest easy. Paul, rest easy. And love to his beautiful daughter, Danielle. That's Elizabeth Bennett, and well done for...
Very much.
Yeah, thank you, Elizabeth. Patricia Blade, Patricia's in Carlow.
Hello.
How are you, Patricia? Now, you came across transplants as it happened a long time ago.
Oh, God, yeah.
I probably was only about 18 or 19, was when I was a student nurse in England in a place called Portsmouth.
Okay.
And they had just started doing the transplants.
Right.
So they were asking any of the student nurses if they want to see the transplants. Of course, I wasn't going to say no.
Okay, well done.
A couple of us went down and it was just amazing. You see this, well, for all the world, let's face it, it's a dead organ. And then they start kind of attaching the veins, the arteries, nerves, whatever. And you see this organ come to life. Sorry, I'm a bit emotional after the last lady.
Yeah, she was so...
And it was just absolutely amazing. Now, I don't know what happened to the patient because they weren't our patients. Like, we were just invited down to see. But I was just talking to my husband now, he's a GP. He's retired. And I said, did you ever see a transplant? And he said, no, he never saw a transplant.
And we were lucky. That description was used earlier as well. But you see the new organ come to life, the kidney come to life.
Yeah.
Or the heart come to life.
Yeah. Because before they sew everything up, they have to make sure, you know, that everything is working. So you actually get a chance to see this organ come to life.
Isn't that incredible?
And I mean, when you think of the people that donate their organs, I mean, their organs from their loved ones come to life from somebody else. And it's just absolutely amazing. I mean, it's nearly as good as watching a child being born. Not quite, though.
Oh,
but it's just amazing, really.
Lovely analogy.
But it's a long time ago. I'm in my 70s now, so...
Yeah. When they say they invited a few student nurses, I remember I was doing a placement in Jervis Street.
Yeah, so,
and I went in to see an operation. But one of the other students with me, who had had children, she fainted. But I was... It's only some people that can see. So you and...
That's why they asked whichever student wanted to go down to theatres. They could see it.
Yeah.
They couldn't stop me. I was in the person's queue.
Brilliant.
I absolutely loved it. And now, Joe, before you go, I am going to miss you so much.
Sometimes
I'd like to slap you.
I know. take out the wooden spoon, as my mother used to say.
But other times I'd be sitting there crying or laughing or something. Something you did. It was just brilliant.
You're very kind. Where did you nurse, Patricia?
Oh, in England, in a place called Portsmouth.
Okay.
My two sisters nurse there as well.
Okay. So, and your husband
is a family of medical people.
I see that. Of service.
Yeah, I don't know how many aunts I've had as nurses as well. Lord rest them. And I've got a few cousins. I'd say we could start a hospital actually.
Okay. Well, onwards. It's that phrase. You can see that you saw the kidney come back to life after the transplant. It's just an amazing scene. Okay, Patricia, kind regards to you and your husband, and thank you both for your service continuing in some shape or form in your day-to-day random acts of kindness, as Roddy mentioned earlier on. Thanks indeed, Patricia. That's Patricia Blade in Carlow. Good morning.